Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 76 of Little Things for Bonsai People. And it is 2024, the year of the wood dragon. And this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Leskovienski. How's it going, Carmen?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Pretty well. You had fun setting up the Japanese garden today?
Whoa, yeah, it was a doozy. Not quite as many trees as usual, but we had some real big ones. But yeah, the trees are going on display at the Portland Japanese Garden starting tomorrow. So anybody who's local should definitely go check it out.
Yep.
A little bit more on that in just a moment. But we do need to introduce our guest today. We have Joey McCoy of Austin, Texas on our show, and he's going to talk to us about Texas native plants and other trees that he uses for bonsai. And I mean, I'm sure there's way more than that, but also his experiences in bonsai. How's it going, Joey?
Hey, everybody. Doing good. Hello from Austin.
Yeah. How's Austin right now?
Sticky and humid, but otherwise a pretty nice day. Good for plants.
Yep. The plants are starting to really vibe right now. It's starting to get sticky and humid in Louisiana as well, but I'm getting a lot of, you know, hardening off growth, and it's a really exciting time of the year for this. And then if we get Mike, he'll be jumping on in a little while. He might kind of jump in the middle of this while I'm going through the script, but we'll just kind of go with the flow. But before we get into that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over on patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head on over there and become a bonsai best bud and hang out in the Discord with these amazing people. Now we have so many patrons, I'm just going to go through and list off the featured best buds and new best buds that we have this week. So we have a new bonsai best bud in Wesley Thompson. Thank you, Wesley, for subscribing and supporting the show. And then this week's featured best bud is Sean Seaman. Thank you for being a best bud for a good chunk of a couple of months now. All the support goes to good use, I promise you. And then we need to also thank our specimen best buds. Always get a shout out. Unrai Yuin Bonsai Garden in Australia, Christina Clarforia, and of course, Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou, the anchor supporting Patreon. Thank you so much, Bill. And then our podcast show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you, John from Joshua Roth's, for being awesome and supporting our show. And then I can't go much further without mentioning Matt O'Donnell, our editor who cleans up our audio, makes us sound smart, makes us enjoyable to listen to. Go over to mattodonnell.com and work with him on your own podcast show if you'd like to. He lives in Nashville, Tennessee. He's a set bassist, and he's all around awesome guy. Say it every time it's in the script. And also go check out Matt O'Donnell wants to know. He's got like a real Irish name going on, two O's on his first name too. Matt O'Donnell wants to know, and it's a little podcast show about people who have cool jobs and people in the music industry he talks to. So, all right. Mike sent me a message a second ago. He'll be popping in just a moment, but let's go ahead and get started talking to you, Joey. Give us a little bit of background information on you as far as bonsai goes.
My adventure with bonsai is kind of a long, weird, convoluted one. I first got into bonsai back in when I was like 3 or 4 years old. My interest was peaked when my parents took me to an exhibit in Hawaii. There was a sushi restaurant that kept bonsai on the rooftop. And
cool.
And we visited that. And I remember as a small kid just looking up at these trees in awe and wonder. And it sort of stuck with me. And as a lot of the children of the 80s, when the Karate Kid came out, either you're into karate or you're into bonsai. And I didn't care about karate, so I wanted little trees. So at that point, you know, I started messing with them there. And then, you know, through school, through college, later on, I've always kind of had this little bonsai tickle in the back of my brain. And I started getting kind of serious about it maybe 20 years ago, and then have been sort of a, you know, maniac about it since then. So I love and appreciate all trees and species, but I really like the things that thrive here that I can, I don't have to fight the weather. I don't have to try to overwinter tropicals as bad. You know, if I can find species that I can collect local, or I can grow easily local. That seems to be my lane I love going down into.
And you also contribute a good bit to the Austin Bonsai Society Club as well. Like you said, you've given classes there in the past, you told me.
Yeah, I've been with the Austin Bonsai Society for about 20 years, and I think I've served all positions on the board there, from, you know, programs, president, and all the things down. I've also served on the board of the Texas State Bonsai Exhibit, as we're building a permanent exhibit here in Austin at the Botanical.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, thank you. And that's a long, slow process, but yeah, we're working through it. the camaraderie of finding other bonsai people cannot be overstated. For so many years, I did not know one other bonsai person. And, you know, struggling along and trying to figure out all of your mistakes by yourself is the worst feeling in the world. When you suddenly have your tribe, it feels great.
And definitely. That's one thing that I always talk about whenever I'm helping out beginners, people who are walking into like say my nursery for the first time here in Folsom, Louisiana. They're always asking me, you know, how do I get into this? I'm always like, there's a local club, and, you know, right down the road, depending on where you're at, either New Orleans or Baton Rouge. And so it's always a great thing to, like you said, find your people, you know, because if you can connect with the people locally, they're going to tell you what's going to work and what's not going to work, you know? And obviously, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on and talk to you about some of these trees that you've been working with, Joey, is that you share a lot of species with me as well. So it's easy to relate with that, but also you get a little bit more of a Western, almost Southwest variety as well, where you're kind of like right on the edge. So kind of tell us like how Austin is set up, like you, how y'all's environment is over there.
Yeah. Like the music festival says, it's South by Southwest. So, you know, we're just right at the crossroads. And here in Austin, we're actually at the point between several ecological zones. You know, we're right on the Balcones Fault, where we have the hill country to the west of us. There's plains sort of to the east of us. There's the, what do you call it? The South Texas plains that kind of comes up through San Antonio just below us. And there's a sort of a convergence of different species that happen right in Austin. And like you say, you know, we have cacti and species that are, you would think about, you'd have in New Mexico, Arizona, you know, they creep into our area. And then we also have bald cypresses and trees that you'd find in the swampy zones. So it's kind of a neat mix where we are.
Yeah. What zone are you officially? Do you know off the top of your head?
You know, it changes, but I think
it does.
I think we're in, I think it's 8B.
Okay.
Look it up. I hate that I don't know that off the top of my
head. That's okay. You know, I think they just changed everything recently, so we can use that as an excuse, because I honestly don't remember what zone I'm in either. But you don't get snow in the winter, do you? Or rarely?
You know, it used to be a real rarity where we would get snow once every 10 years or so. But probably the last, at least the last 6 years, every winter has been unpredictable, uncontrollable. The winter of 21, if you live anywhere in Texas, it's probably burned in your brain, because that was the one where the entire state went under no electricity. And in Austin, we got down to, I believe, 6 degrees, and it stayed there for 4 days. I lost half my collection. It was
That's really cold.
Yeah. So, but even this last year, we were down to 12, which used to be a just oddity. But now I'm beginning to think this is sort of our new normal. You prepare for it. And the summers are getting a little hotter too. You know, it used to be a little more mild, and we're having spikes that we didn't have 20 years ago. So
yeah, it's been really strange to kind of be living in this time where you can actually see and remember, you know, you can actually see your climate changing. Like, I remember back to elementary school, what the winters were like versus now, and it's like, it's crazy to just be experiencing it in real time. But yeah, the cold winters can be really rough, especially when you're you know, not prepared for it. It can be, even when you are prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're not in the North area where we even have houses that are, you know, insulated properly for that kind of thing, or pipes. It's crazy. And even, you know, going back to bonsai, Texas natives that we have that live here around Austin, which I've never really protected in the wintertime, other than putting them on the ground and doing a little covering. You know, I lost all kinds of stuff. That was a, was a big surprise to me at that. Of course, I had no idea we were getting quite that cold.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's rough.
Yeah.
So with all that change and whatnot, I mean, how are you starting to make adjustments now for winter? Are you having to cold storage some of your trees than you formerly wouldn't have to? Or is there micro and like climates that you set up? Like, how are you kind of managing that?
Yeah, so I tell friends around here that I have, like, you know, DEFCON 1, DEFCON 2. It's like, you know, these different, you know, panic situations depending on where the temperature goes. And I now set up little cold frames, you know, mostly using tents and things like that that I can, because I don't have, I'm in a suburban area, so I don't really have the room for anything commercial.
Hi, guys.
How's it going, Mike?
Good. How are you?
Yeah. Thanks for popping in, everybody.
Well, now we have to start all over.
Mike Lane. Yeah, we got to start from the top.
Hey, what's up, Carmen? How are we doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. What's up, Joey? How you doing?
Doing great, Mike. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Excellent. How's it been in your part of the world, Mike?
Well, it's going great.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. It's, we're doing good. Amelia's starting to laugh and do her, she's starting to really respond and come alive. So we're having a good time playing with her.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's good stuff. You'll be there soon.
Yeah, I know. In about, what is it, 3 months now?
Yep.
27 days, 20, like, not 27 days.
Weeks.
Weeks, yeah. No. Something like that. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, you're over halfway there.
Yep.
While we're speaking of babies, no, this is not an announcement for me, but my best friend is going to have a baby. And I'm so excited. And so I'm just going to tell everybody that my best friend is having a baby.
And you get to hold a baby soon, too. Is that, that's what that means. But it's not your baby.
It's not my baby. I get to give it back when I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, so we were talking to Joey about his climate in Austin and how things have been different recently, and about how he's had to change up his protection plan over winter. And I'm just kind of checking in too, because I know over here in Louisiana, it's a lot more humid, a lot more wet. And then you guys have it a lot drier than what I'm used to. Like, I don't even know how to deal with a dry climate like that, Joey. So how do y'all kind of, like, especially with tropicals, how do you kind of deal with that?
Well, I mean, we're not the desert. So, I mean, you came through. We have lakes and rivers.
It's,
and
it's drier than I'm used to.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's all perspective. So, I mean, we're a lot more dry than you are, but then I have, you know, cousins who come down from Dallas and they're just like, I can't stand the humidity in Austin. How can you tolerate this? And so, yeah, it's location. Yeah. I don't know. You get used to whatever, I guess, climate and area that you have. You get used to watering and your trees adapt and you adapt, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. So it's weird because it's like a dry feeling, like it's drier air feeling down there, but I can feel the humidity because it's because you know, like when it gets hot, you get sticky, but like my lips chap slightly there, so that means there's some degree of, you know, a little bit drier.
You live in a swamp, so
yeah, literally,
right, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's different.
Goes anywhere other than Louisiana. Like Louisiana has moss everywhere.
Yeah, like compared to Florida, I mean, now that we're talking about like different humidity levels, I haven't even really checked on how it is in Fort Myers, Mike. What's the humidity
right now?
Right
it's
here?
Right now it's like it's 80, I think, something like that. It's not as high as it's going to be, but it's hot.
Okay.
Yeah. What's your humidity level?
Like 80%.
You're swimming.
I think. Let me look at what it is right now. It might not be that bad. Let me check. You guys go on. I'll tell you.
We typically settle around like 110% Louisiana. That's like not
it's
even
like
a
raining
joke.
While it's sunny. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's blazing hot in the middle of summer, and then we get good amount of rain. Like
Oh, no, we're only 44%. Sorry.
Oh, it's more humid here. We're at 49%.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys are talking about how Austin is so, you know, dry. I'm looking it up right now. In Austin, it's 93%.
Oh, wow.
No, that's what I was saying. It was muggy.
Wow.
We're swimming in the air.
So. Yeah.
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 Welcome to the Little Things podcast, where we talk about the weather at least once per episode.
Mm-hmm.
That's important, you know?
Yeah.
My trees, I have to water my trees twice a day, my show hen right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm probably at once a day watering.
Yeah. A quick question for you, Mike, about your show hen, because I'm starting to stumble into the show hen world a little bit more and more.
Robert,
thanks for introducing me to sea hibiscus.
Oh, yeah.
You made my life really, really interesting and really difficult with these little guys.
Good.
Because they grow so fast. Now,
yes.
I'm going to start double potting them basically this time of the year, unless I'm slowing them down for refinement. That's one of my questions for you real quick.
Yeah. Double potting is good. Double potting is not as good as having not potted it in the first place. Like, that's something I'm learning. Like, I use double potting. I still do it because I don't know. I sometimes want to move something forward and start getting it into a bonsai. But like, honestly, time and time again, it's proven more efficient. And when I look at the photos and I look at the time invested, if I just pot something in a bigger pot, it grows way more efficiently. I grow it much, much faster. So the double potting, yes, it's useful. And now is a good time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But going forward, like, I would, any projects, I wouldn't count on double potting anymore to like fix that. I'm trying to be more efficient and I'm trying to be more patient, I guess, is my point.
Yeah. Yeah, get to the point where it's appropriate to not have to rely on that. Yeah,
exactly. But I still, you know, I'm a human, and I still want to pot things and get things. I buy a new pot and I want to use it, you know. So sometimes I do stuff like that, and that's when double potting does come into play. It gets me out of those snags.
So, back to Joey here. So we're talking about show in and stuff, and I remember I visited your backyard, what was that, 4 weeks ago? I can't remember how long ago it was.
About a month, something like that,
Barely a month, yeah. And I remember you had a really good variety of different sized trees back there, so everything from show in all the way up to near imperial sized trees. What do you really like? What do you like to work on? What's your preferred size, I would say?
Hmm.
I know it's just... swinging it out there.
Depends on my mood of the day, I suppose. That's why I have all the different varieties and sizes. And, you know, sometimes it's fun to work on the little guys. I mean, you know, they can sometimes develop quickly, but they can fall apart pretty quickly too. So
yeah, for sure.
You had a whole backyard of show in, that would be,
that'd be a nightmare. It would be fun to see everything develop so fast, but then everything downfalls so quickly in the middle of the summer. Couldn't get ahead of it. So tell us about some of the Texas natives that you got going on there. I know we were alluding to that earlier. So one of the ones I know, one of the reasons why I stumbled across your yard is because I was seeking out a Texas persimmon. And that species really intrigues me. So Texas persimmon, and I know that there's a couple other ones that I've heard that you guys have, like the ash juniper, if I'm correct on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our local native juniper here is the ash juniper. Everybody here calls it a cedar tree, which is annoying because there's no cedars in Texas.
Everything's a cedar.
Everything. And then we have a beautiful elm that's called a cedar elm because it lives with the juniper that they kill. They can't call it juniper.
So that's the case. Okay.
Truly.
Not because the bark is cedar-like, which it's not.
Yes.
Wow. I didn't know that. That makes it even more silly. I like that.
That's interesting. I didn't know that either. That's why they call them cedar elms. They grow where the cedars, the quote-unquote cedars are.
Where the junipers grow.
Right. Junipero.
It's the funniest thing I've ever heard.
and the problem is, you know, even bonsai people here will get their words tripped up, and they'll call the ash, juniper, cedar, elm because you're trying to say cedar tree. And anyway, that's just...
Yeah.
But yeah, so ash, juniper is great. The cedar elm is fantastic. You know, rough, corky bark that you don't see on many native elms in the world. Live oak trees, you guys in the South, you guys, you know, you can play with the Southern live oak just as much.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Might be a little bit more difficult than others, but because of how hard it is to find a suitable tree in the wild, which I don't know if you guys struggle with that as much as we do, because they tend to be very straight, almost just like a log. If you pulled it out of the woods, it wouldn't be very interesting. Log trees, yeah. Just carve them and make them interesting, but that's the only thing you can do with a big tree like that. So,
yep. But see, I think that's the case with most plants that you're going to collect. 90% of what you're going to find is not really suitable for bonsai. Mm-hmm. You have to look for those areas that have, you know, had some sort of damage or cattle chewed or I don't know, you know, along railroad lines where they've been chopping them back for many years or something, you know, something that kind of gives the plant some character before you commit.
Yeah. And I'm guessing you would have a lot more Yamadori or wild tree collecting experiences out there too within all the time frame that you've been doing bonsai.
Oh yeah. Wild digs and lots of urban digs. I'm about to do my third urban dig this spring, this weekend. So
yeah, what you gonna go grab this weekend?
There's the best material there is dwarf yopons that were planted in 1984.
Mm. Ooh,
they're
that's cool.
Huge, but when I was given permission to come out and take a look at them, in order to see the trunks, I had to kind of soldier crawl down through the the trunks, you know, to get photos and count them all up. And they're nice up close. And, you know,
that's cool.
That's, to me, the material is the thing, you know, and it doesn't matter if that's in front of somebody's house. That's as nice as something you find out in the field. The plant doesn't know any different. So,
Yeah. Yopon is a... The Yopon holly, especially the dwarf variety that people normally use for landscaping, a lot of people don't realize that that's a sleeper hit of a tree right there. If you find and a shrub, like you said, 1989?
84. Yeah.
84. Yeah. I mean, the tree's well over 30, near 40 years old at this point. The bases on those trees, if I had to guess, and I've seen a few photos of some of the stuff that you've dug not too long ago, was also other yopons, the base has got to be anywhere from 4 to 6 inches across.
Or more. Yeah.
Or more. Mean, oh, wow. Yeah.
Sometimes they'll kind of elephant foot out and you find these just bases that are a foot wide. Sometimes it's multi-trunked at that point and you have to figure out what you're going to do with it. But yeah, they don't, it's a wonderful thing I guess the nursery industry gave us a gift when they developed those, because not only did they have the small leaves, but they like to thicken up the trunk instead of growing straight up like a pole, like the native yopons do. So
they also want fruit though.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. The shillings won't.
But it will make a very lovely cluster of flowers on the short internet.
It will. Yeah, it will. That's true.
Yeah. I've got one that I'm trying to show at Bonsai Central, and it is just relentlessly flowering, and it will not backbud and poof back out. So it's just at the expense of the flowers. It's dropping a couple of leaves every day or so, and I'm just like, come on, man. I know you want to do this right now. And that's one of the things, too, is it's funny I say come on, man, because they literally are like the male variety, so they can't produce the fruit,
yes,
which is unique to that, to the dwarf. But yeah, like I know with one of the trees I was really interested in, like I told you earlier, was the Texas persimmon. And I wanted to kind of lean into that a little bit more because I just think it's such a weird and cool tree. And in mine that I got from you, Joey, it has the flowers were kind of like a white, and then they curled in, they kind of started turning dark, and they're starting to turn black a little bit. Will it cross? Does it need a cross pollinate, or can it be pollinated? Like, I can't remember what that's called. Carmen, that's a question for you.
Dioecious or monoecious?
Yeah, is it dioecious or monoecious?
It is dioecious, so yes, it needs the two, exactly.
It needs a mate. Okay, cool.
And the flowers are different. So if you're in the wild and you're trying to collect one, if you're at the right time of year, Usually the flowers that kind of hang down like a little bell, those tend to be the female flowers. Ones that are a little more upright and they're more like a little tube, those are the male flowers.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for reference, there is a I'm trying to see the date when you posted this image. So if somebody wants to jump over to your Instagram, there's one you have where it's got fruits all over it and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It says it's number 24. Give us that nomenclature on the Texas persimmon.
You mean the botanical?
Yes.
So it is Diosporus texana.
Yeah. So
it's a Diosporus.
Yeah, it's a Diosporus.
Oh, interesting.
Texas persimmon.
Yeah.
And they make little black fuzzy fruits. They're kind of the size of a large marble. You know, the shooting marble kind of size. A little less than a ping pong, maybe. That are edible.
Do they taste good?
Well, yeah, exactly. Edible, flavorful.
It's not bad, actually. It's kind of kind of tastes like a little like a plum.
Okay.
But it's mostly seed, so you're really not going to get much fruit. People use them for jellies and stuff. They don't really eat them.
That's one of those jellies where it takes, I'm sure, a good number of them to... For, is it worth the squeeze is kind of what the question is.
I'll eat them off my own bonsai because I know I'm not poisoning them. So I'll just, you know, when they start to ripen up, it's either me or the possums. So I walk my water.
Yeah, beat the possums to it. Mm-hmm. Sure.
For reference, I found the image. The date was August 5th, 2022 on Joey Bonsai off of Instagram. If you guys want to see a Texas persimmon with fruit all over it, a multi-trunk tree, you probably know what I'm talking about, Joey.
I do.
Yeah, it's very lovely. It almost reminds me of like the way a crepe myrtle grows in a weird way, but not as, obviously not as like coarse of a growing plant. It's much finer, which is kind of terrifying to me because I was attempting to wire some of the branches of the one you had given me, and it's just like you were right, like, any little move, if you breathe on it too hard, it just pops.
It's really brittle.
Yeah, super brittle.
That's what I was telling you. There's like this nice little window where you can wire them when it's hard to kind of explain when that is, because if you try to wire the branches when they're too young and they're just a little bit too green, there's no lignified wood inside. They just break off, split off very easily. They'll just shear off the trunk or off the branches. If you wait too long. Any little twist or bend, sometimes you get cracks. They don't always recover from that. So you can, you know, end up losing fine branches that way. So there's this kind of nice little window. Yaupon hollies are the same way. If people are used to dealing with those, they can get extremely brittle after a certain point, and you're just not going to move those branches much. Especially the fine pieces. When you want to do fine wiring, you just end up cracking stuff up.
Hey everyone, this is John Eads, founder of Left Coast Bonsai and proud supporter of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast. I'm breaking into your feed today to let you know about a few exciting things we're doing here at Left Coast Bonsai. We're a small, family-owned bonsai nursery that's focused on producing high-quality bonsai plant material, as well as sourcing hard-to-find supplies for growing in your own yard. For many of us, winter is a time to pause and reflect on the year ahead. Now's a good time to decide what seedlings and supplies you need for the upcoming season. We have a large selection of seedlings that will begin shipping out mid-February for our spring season. You can also order baskets, felt bags, or aluminum wire. In addition to the seedlings and supplies, I also teach classes and study groups on a broad range of subjects, including growing trees from scratch. I hope to hear from you soon and would love to talk about how we can support your bonsai growing journey. You can find us online at leftcoastbonsai.com, on Instagram at leftcoastbonsai, or send me an email at talk@leftcoastbonsai.com. Cheers!
Oh, hey, Carmen, did I tell you about Bonsai Central yet?
No, I don't think you have.
Oh, I think I might have mentioned it a few other times, but it's going to be May 3rd through 5th in 2024 in St. Louis, Missouri. It's basically the national show, but it's going to be Central America, and it's going to be an awesome show with cash awards and prizes. There's going to be a professional bonsai show and a kusamono show as well.
Ooh.
With the presentation during dinner with for rewards and whatnot. But if you want to submit a tree, I think you have to submit 2 to 4 photos, and you need a brief description of your tree and send it over to the contact form at bonsaicentral.com. That's bonsai-central.com. But I think there's going to be vendors there too. Do you know what vendors were included? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard that it's going to be something like 25 plus of the best vendors from around the country. So, like, including nurseries, potters, stand makers, tool suppliers, and all of that.
But, like, specifically, I thought I heard that there was going to be American potters. Like,
oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, now Tochu Take is going to be there. Vicky Chamberlain, Eli Atkins of Waldo Street Pottery, April Grigsby, Roy Minari, and Byron Merrick. Sellers of imported Japanese and antique Chinese pots are going to be there, too.
That's amazing. I mean, there must be, like, a pretty good lineup for this show as far as, like, their headliners. There should be some really good bonsai artists. Do you have any idea who that might be? I think I might have heard about Bjorn, but there's some other ones, right?
Oh, yeah. Bjorn's going to be there. Tyler Sherrod as well. Maria Hayek, Andrew Robson, Mauro Stemberger, and Young Cho.
Oh.
I think there's going to be workshops, show walkthroughs, critiques, all that stuff.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. There should be somewhere to go on bonsai-central.com, and you can fill out the opportunities to do workshops with these professionals. They have really great material, I've heard. It's going to be stuff like twisted junipers and old fused maples and really awesome pieces of material for Young's kusamono class. So I think if you guys are interested, y'all should go check out bonsai-central.com and see if you can register for the show, sign up for workshops if they're still available. But I'll definitely be there this year.
Awesome. That's sweet.
Yeah, thank you, Bonsai Central, for sponsoring our show.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
So you can compare it to, because I know what you mean by yopons. Now that you said that, it kind of connects a, it makes a connection in my brain. I'm always trying to, you know, make those connections. It helps me out a lot. But the yopon, I know what you mean. There's like the very first flush kind of starts to come out, and then it's semi-hard. It like kind of turns, like it's not quite lignified, like you said. It's kind of turned that like kind of purpley color from green. It's kind of like how bald cypresses do the same thing, where they go from green to like a magenta reddish color. It's kind of a weird, it's hard to explain. But that's pretty much the signal that that is going to actually lignify. It's not just going to be like, I don't know. I guess this is a question for you, Carmen. If a tree, I have this happen on bald cypresses quite a bit. If a tree sends out a green shoot and the shoot just stays green throughout the year, it normally falls off for me. But if it does turn that reddish color, like toward lignification, I can actually trim it. It'll stick around even though it's not fully lignified. Is there a way to look at that, Carmen?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Have you heard of that before?
No.
Okay. Maybe that's something that I'm used to with bald cypresses. Bald cypresses do that to me all the time.
Just put out a little green shoot and then it doesn't lignify. It just falls off.
Yeah. Sometimes. Okay. And it depends. And Mike, you might have some input on this too. is that sometimes a bald cypress, that it'll get extremely vigorous. It'll put out these big, giant, fat, green shoots that never really
Shoots. Those are water shoots.
Water shoots. There you go.
Yeah.
So
that's I don't know the science behind those, though. Maybe Carmen does. Carmen, you know what a water shoot is, right?
Yeah, like, but those. I don't know why they would fall off unless they just don't need them anymore.
Why does a plant even do that? Why does a plant push water shoots?
Now, Evan, are you talking about they fall off in the growing season, or they fall off like at the end of the year because they haven't lignified?
Well, it's like post leaf defoliation, like for the fall, and then that twig it might stick around, but it doesn't fully adapt to becoming lignified. It could be there next year, but it just won't bud. It's just like a hollow piece of not even wood. It's just like a hollow piece of growth.
I've seen those on mine too. I think that if it like you're saying, if it doesn't lignify by the end of the year, it doesn't act like a branch. It acts like a leaf.
Yeah, just forever.
It kind of is a leaf, you know, as it grows out. But I think it just aborts that section.
Yeah.
What
happens. Yeah, and it's like even though like the stem of that shoot will fatten up, like it's going to become a lignified branch. Like Mike said, it's a water shoot, which I didn't have a name for that type of growth until now. It's pretty cool. I can use that. It's another vocabulary thing. But, you know, I know that crepe myrtles are also kind of in that same vein where we talk about them similar to the Texas persimmon, where crepe myrtle does come out soft and smushy, and then it gets like that weird kind of edged look to its growth where it looks like a little square. It's like squared off, and that's kind of like your time to do very, very careful wiring. So I guess that's kind of comparable to the Texas persimmon as well.
Yeah, and they have very thin bark the same way, or no bark, just this, you know, slippery sort of trunk. So there's a lot of similarities with persimmon and crepe myrtle, and yeah, you could style them the same.
Sure. Yeah. And so with your natives, such as like say the Texas persimmon or your ash juniper, do they fall into a place where you could try to do classical styles, or is it easier to go with their natural forms, or is it just more of a challenge, you know, to try to get classical?
I don't think it would be difficult at all to do a more classical, you know, kind of domed feel that you would see in with sort of thicker. The difficulty, of course, is getting the proper proportions, because like you're talking about trying to find, we said about live oaks, you know, everything looks like a telephone pole. Finding the right proportions that you would create a classical bonsai out of is always a challenge. But Texas persimmons have some strange qualities. So it's a fruit tree, but it doesn't heal wounds very well, especially on old wood. So if you do big chops, you're going to always have a big chop. You're not going to have that classical bonsai that it's going to heal and seal all the little wounds and cuts. And you're not going to have, you know, you're going to have a broadleaf tree that has no flaws on it. You're always going to have flaws. You embrace the flaws.
Yeah.
Because of that, if you want to keep the natural taper of a collected tree, you're going to make it probably a little taller than what would be classically thought about. That's why when you look at that one that I have on Instagram, it's sort of a long and reaching open tree that may not look like something you'd ever see as a traditional classical bonsai, but it's more, that's actually closer to what we have as persimmons around here. They kind of, they look like that. They reach and branch.
Wait a minute.
Distances.
Yeah. And you don't get to see a lot of trees in that taller, more, it's a lot more of a feminine style, especially for the Texas persimmon. I do enjoy tall, thinner trees. I think it's kind of silly for me to say that, because I go look at my collection in my backyard here, and a lot of my trees would be called what you would describe as pigs, or are like fat, almost sumo. But it's a little deceiving whenever I try to, you know, talk to people about their long, graceful trunk lines, and how, yeah, like you said, that's very enjoyable, especially if that's just what the tree's going to give you, if it's a wild collector tree and you just got to go with the flaws. But Texas persimmons also have a deadwood quality to them that I found to be really intriguing as well. So,
Going along with the idea that they don't heal over the wounds, you're going to end up with areas that you've chopped if you're collecting a plant, especially. And the deadwood is both very, very hard. So it can take tools and carving really, really nicely, and it won't rot away very easily. But it also oxidizes black in the air. So just exposing it to the air, it'll look like it's been through a fire. It's really interesting.
That's cool.
I don't know stylistically that you would want to keep like long gins like a juniper. I don't even know how long that would last. But anything that's like a shari or an uro or anything else that's coming through there that normally you might darken, it's going to do that all on its own and a lot quicker than most species. So this isn't something that you would ever lime sulfur the dead wood. This is something you want to, or you still could, you know, if you like that, or put a little bit of India ink in it, whatever, and have a silvery look, I suppose. But the deadwood quality of them, I think, is one of the reasons that people should look at them as well. In the same maybe mindset as how they do ume in Japan. Old ume always have some sort of deadwood character to them, it seems.
Yeah. And you sent me some deadwood examples in the past when I was asking you about how the deadwood should look, because in the case that you need to go in and make some adjustments for like a tree that's been chopped, or there's a spot where a branch was cut and you want to try to go in and reenact kind of like how the deadwood happens in nature on these trees. And it seems like because they are a little bit brittle, they do have the tendency to break, you know, especially bigger trees tend to break in half just about in nature. Or how have you experienced them in the wild?
I've never had something like where I've run across something that's broken in half. They're very hardwood, pretty darn durable. But okay. Whole branches can shear off from animals or cars or whatever. So you'll see wounds on the trunk pretty easily, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about with the way some of the trees are here. I mean, we have trees literally break in half. And I don't know if that's just the way it is because we have a lot of trees that fall over here. But I could see that with the hardwood of the Texas persimmon being very hard, that it could sustain from that type of damage. And so like, I guess next time you would want to create deadwood, you could literally just take a branch and rip it down the side gently, not trying to destroy the entire tree, obviously, but that would be characteristic of how they would look in nature, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You could, if you wanted to make an interesting, like if you're taking off a branch or the branch dies or whatever your stylistic choice is, you can either take it off, hollow the darn thing out. You could leave it on there and do a little bit of interesting carving, or what I find more interesting, take the branch and split it maybe horizontally and then just tear it down. So you're leaving a little bit of a jag at the top, but you're also creating a hole down inside of the wound. You know, I'm not a huge proponent of wounding your trees just for the heck of it. So this is, it would be a purposeful style.
No, that's awesome. I mean, I'm very intrigued by the species. And I would hope to be able to get some more. And I know our listeners we'd be wondering, would you be able to find these Texas persimmons anywhere? Or are they just kind of like, you have to come to Texas and just kind of figure it out?
I actually don't know that they grow anywhere outside of Texas. Mexico, you can find them in Mexico if there's listeners there. There's bonsai people in Dallas who are real interested because apparently they don't really grow as far north as Dallas. So they're sort of middle of the state down. And you can find them in nurseries, but like most plants that are nursery grown from, I don't know how they're doing it, cutting or seeds or something, they're not interesting. They're not very old. They don't have...
The Texas persimmon does remind me of a native plant that we have here called the huckleberry, or it's a Vaccinium elliotti, or Elliott's blueberry, that grows in the native range here. It's a little tiny, you guys might have them as well. It's a little tiny huckleberry blueberry plant that it grows fairly low. It can get thick in the base, but it does take multiple trunks to kind of start developing for it to even get anything remarkable to it. Are you familiar with huckleberries there?
No, I don't think they're in our area. They might be more towards East Texas, Houston area, and north. Hey. I mean, that sounds more of a the deep woods kind of species. I don't think we have that here.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit more understory, but the wood, like you're describing it, it reminds me so much of the Texas persimmon, where the hardwood is solid. It's very, very hard. And like you said, like if I were to cut that huckleberry, it would never heal. I would never be able to get that look of the classical style, especially if it was more wild collected and it had that little bit more of a twisted, weird trunk to it. And its wood is similar to the American hornbeam, does the same thing as well, where it oxidizes and turns dark color. It doesn't turn black, but it turns like a grayish color before it actually starts rotting. Or if it does rot, it just rots immediately. You know what I mean? So you guys also have American hornbeam there as well. Correct? Or is it a little too far for you?
Not in our area. Yeah, not. I had never played with one up close and personal before I got the one from you. So cool. I think they're found again way East Texas, but that's a long way.
It's like there's that line drawn right there, like we were saying, like you said, south right. by southwest. So it's just odd to me because I know that's where the whole thing is. Like, I know a American hornbeam will do great for you because I've seen people grow them in their gardens there. So it's just like you said, it's right on that line. So do you have much information on the ash juniper as much as you would on the Texas persimmon, as we could describe that? I didn't even get to look at those.
Oh yeah, some. I've been collecting those for years too, and you know, it's funny. 20 years ago or more now, whatever year it was that I sort of joined Austin Bonsai Society, there were all of these people that would advise what would be a new member and tell them what to do and what not to do. And one of them, they said, don't bother with ash juniper. It's not collectible. You won't ever turn it into a bonsai. Nobody messes. A few crazy people mess with those, but don't bother. I became very good friends with some folks up in Dallas, the Smiths, and some other collectors, both in Fort Worth and Dallas. And Dr. Bill Cody, who was in our Austin club, did lots of research into the ash juniper. And actually, there's a book published this through the Texas State Bonsai Exhibit. It's out of print right now, but about collecting it and how they grow and the different different nuances of the plant. So I've had many different opportunities to both look for and then collect ash juniper. And yeah, they're great. You have to treat them a little different, at least in our area. The best ones are the ones that are found on cap rock areas. So our landscape, Austin and westward, is very rocky, with outcroppings and rocky hills where it's slowly sort of worn down over time. And there's little pockets that the trees grow in. And there are hills that you'll find nothing but the ash junipers because it's so dry and so hot and nothing else. A few oaks will sometimes grow there. I imagine it's like any mountain area. If you can find the plant in a little pocket, you're going to have the best luck. People try to dig them from more of a bottom land area like that we have east of Austin, where you have fields and deep, rich black earth, and either they won't survive or the material just doesn't look very good because it hasn't been tortured for many years. So if you can find the ones that are growing on rock, always look for limestone. Those are usually your best ones.
Yeah.
That's the same with the buttonwoods here. Yeah. Growing shallow root systems, growing on like a cap rock or anything like that. And you won't get a telephone pole.
Yeah,
exactly. And our ash juniper, by the way, it'll turn into a, you know, big full-size tree. You know, you could have a 30-foot tree that has a, you know, a trunk larger than you can put your arms around. The locals here don't like them because they, you know, put a lot of pollen in the air during the winter, and they tend to compete with cattle. And so I think there's been a an unfortunate campaign against them from certain people in Texas for many years. And there's even controversy here in Texas that they're not native, that they were brought here. And so we must eradicate this invasive plant. And there's whole communities that will go through and take them out of the entire little small city. Stupid.
Yeah.
That's what they do. So I've found the best way to collect those. And this is also through collaboration with other people. So it's not all just me, but you find the proper tree that you're able to dig. So you find kind of a pocket if you're able to. You do a lot of little, you know, poking in the ground, and you try to find where a plant isn't taking a nosedive too deeply into the ground, but it's more contained, which you can wiggle the trunk a little bit and watch the soil move. If there's enough roots on the surface, you'll kind of see a little bit of movement back and forth. And you collect a large enough root ball with the least amount of disturbance and carefully take it home, plant it out. There's other steps in between, but carefully take it home, plant it out, and in a largish container with bonsai soil underneath and around it, and then wait for the little roots to kind of venture into the next zone. And then over the next 2 to 3 years, you begin to remove the native soil slowly. You do maybe half 1 year and then half the next, or one third, one third, one third, depending on the tree and how vigorous it is.
Yeah.
But that's not that unusual from a lot of conifer collection that people do. So.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. One of my last visits I got to experience, one of my last visits up to Michael's garden, I got to experience a Yamadori that had been collected, but it was already a refined bonsai, and we had to go in and take out more field soil, and it just scared the crap out of me because I'm like not familiar with that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? But that like pie slice kind of quartering the field soil out, depending on the health of the tree, is very vital, like you said, to a lot of conifer collecting.
Yeah, it's but once you have a one of our ash junipers, and by the way, Austin is primarily a broadleaf place. You find ash junipers and you have other things that people plant, but that's kind of our only conifer in the area. Until you get outside of Austin, you find some loblolly pine, but not even here in Austin. So, but once you have the ash juniper in a container and it's, you know, in a pot, it just acts like any other juniper. It's, you know, it's, there's nothing very finicky about it compared to any other juniper that I've encountered.
Yeah.
Do they get the twists and stuff like some of the Rocky Mountain junipers or Western junipers naturally?
Yeah. The best ones I'll do. Yeah. And I mean, of course you find them that are just straight and boring and there's nothing to them. And the majority of what you see, they look like a little fat Christmas tree. You know, they're a little point and there's kind of a little shape, and those are useless for bonsai. So
yeah, it's kind of like Eastern red cedar, you know, it's like it's kind of a boring thing until you find something really different.
Exactly. I think that's the case with all species.
Yeah.
But yeah, ash juniper is a I think a really good ash juniper can compete with any top tier juniper anywhere in the country.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of finding it. And I think that there probably hasn't been as much interest and search for that particular species as there has been for other ones. So, but there's some great examples out there. That show up, especially in the state conventions.
And so they can have the really nice deadwood features of any other wild collected juniper could have, correct?
Absolutely. Those are the only ones I collect. If they have white deadwood, and especially if I can find a fin or something else coming off of it, that's what you look for. That's age. Mm. That's history.
Yeah. Are they brittle compared to other junipers, or
I've heard that from people, and I don't find them brittle. I was, somebody had a blog or a podcast or something I was listening to, and they were talking about how brittle the ash juniper is, and I have never found that to be the case.
Interesting.
Unless other junies are just, you know, big wiggly things, and I don't have anything to compare to, because I don't have a California juniper or Sierra. I don't have any of those, so
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with the other native that you had listed earlier, the cedar elm. So that's the Ulmus crassifolia, correct?
Ulmus, yeah.
And what did I say? Ulmus. I always say Ulmus, but Ulmus crassifolia. But yeah. So that one. So I know there's this debate on whether the Ulmus alata or the Ulmus crassifolia are the same tree, which is the winged elm versus the cedar elm.
Right. They're not.
They're not. So your take on that is they're not. Because I talked to a lot of people. I mean, and not to call you out, Mike, but me and you had that conversation recently too. You know?
Yeah. I don't think they're the same tree. I think you have hybrids.
Yes, yeah, you can. Yes. Yeah. So they also call the cedar elm the Texas cedar elm sometimes, what I've heard, because it is predominantly in your range. Or how do you feel about that? Do you feel like that's a Texas predominant plant?
I looked at the range of it, and I think it goes up quite a ways, you know, past Oklahoma, and you may even find it in places of Louisiana. I don't know for sure. It has a pretty big range, but it is all over Texas. And, you know, if you look out the window, primarily you're going to see here, you're going to see live oaks, you're going to see cedar elm, you're going to see southern hackberry.
Yeah,
those are kind of the three dominant trees in our landscape.
And so the southern hackberry, is that the one we're talking about that has the little raised wart areas that come up on the bark, or is that the smoother one?
No, it's the raised one. Yeah, yep. Celtis labigata.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really beautiful one. I have one of those in my backyard right now, and I'm really bad about the two different varieties, the smooth versus the little corky, weird wart covered one. But yeah, that's also a beautiful tree as well. I'm getting now to experience that hackberry for the first time. I was fortunate that guy, Guidry, lent me a few of his more developed pieces. I've been kind of working with them. It's an amazingly fine twigged tree. I'm loving it, but I can only assume that it takes a very long time to develop some of the branching on those trees.
Yes. It takes a while, but I mean, compared to a lot of other trees, they'll create fine branching pretty quickly, and it'll create finer branches than our cedar elms, and certainly than the oaks, great leaf reduction. Hey. You know, you can get little bitty tiny leaves in these little guys if you stay on top of it, or if you want to, you know, prep it for a show or something.
Yeah. And I find that with the cedar elm too, it can actually get quite small.
Smaller, yes, for sure.
The smallest that you've seen.
What's that?
Not the smallest that you've seen. That's what I'm kind of picking up.
No, the hackberry beats them. But that's another funny one, because there's a lot of, at least Texans, that don't grow our southern hackberry tree as a bonsai. They think of it as a weed tree. This is what people take out of their yards because, you know, it doesn't heal wounds very well. So when you have a storm and a big branch cracks, you're going to end up with a hollow trunk, which is probably going to fall over on your car. So the next thing you see is people are chopping these things out of their yards. And the idea is, I don't want that. That's a weed tree. So,
yeah.
Those are the best bonsai, though.
Yeah. Those are the battered ones.
Yeah.
And we have them over here where the southern hackberry will get very tall, and it's almost like towering. It's a very intimidating tree in a way, because the bark on them is so, it's like near white. It's very awesome looking. And then we have a little bit more storm winds and stuff over here, so the tops of our hackberries have a tendency to be blown out, and so we'll have these big twisted, crazy looking twisted branches sticking off the top, and then that will cause these giant stripes down the trunk. So you have this beautiful contrast of this grayish, kind of old, stripey deadwood. And then the way that the hackberry heals, it doesn't heal over the deadwood. It kind of bubbles out. The callus gets really thick, and then it looks like it kind of melts around the hollows. And I think that's kind of something that, like, we tend to turn away from in bonsai, especially in classical bonsai, when deciduous trees are supposed to be scarless trunked. And so hackberry kind of lends itself to that, because, like you said, with the Texas persimmon, like, kind of go with it, you know, kind of go with its, embellish its flaws in a way, you know.
One thing is, like, we hear a lot about, like, certain trees aren't, you can't heal them, or like bougainvillea don't heal, ilex don't heal. But if you go to Taiwan and you see, like, the trees that they have bougainvillea with, like, perfect trunks. And they have all these difficult-to-heal trees with perfect trunks. And, like, what I've noticed is, under the clip-and-grow paradigm, is you basically have to divide that wound by two. So you have to grow two branches that are healing that wound 50-50. And then no matter how big the tree is, it's just math, is if you thicken it to 50% of that wound and you thicken the other branch to 50% of that wound, then the wound is gone. And you now create two 50% smaller wounds, and you slowly work that out until the tree is fully grown. And that's any species. You know, the only time where we get screwed with wounds is when we try to grow one for one. So on a lot of trees, you have to regrow what you cut off to heal the wound. So if I'm trying to grow taper, then you get nothing.
And
so really, like, the, at least like the way they do it in Taiwan and stuff like that, is everything's just divided by two and you're healing the wound by two branches at all times.
Yep.
Well, also, Taiwan, especially the plants that you're talking about, they're starting them off young, working them as a bonsai. Those aren't old collected things that are, you know, the size wounds that they're trying to heal are not giant. They're creating these perfect trunks by, you know, this careful mathematical thing like you're talking about that starts way early.
Sure.
And it's gorgeous.
And yeah. But that thing, like, that's what my gripe is, just when people say that stuff won't heal. Like, yeah, like old wounds on old trees won't, but like the species itself, I think you can grow a flawless anything. So yeah. Any variety of tree.
Correct. And by the way, when I was talking about persimmons and healing, I'm talking about collected plants. If you start with a seed, you know, and you're growing them out, and you're cutting it as you go along, there will come a point where you're not going to be able to cover those wounds very well. But as a young tree and as it puts out a lot of that, you know, fresh growth and fresh callus, you can get a lot of wound coverage for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. There's also a difference between like a deciduous tree. So a maple will unexpectedly crawl across that wound without having to grow two branches. So you can heal one-to-one with a maple, and that's fine. And you will get taper with that. A crepe myrtle will do the same. Stewardia will do the same. But most of the tropicals that we'll work with won't heal that way. And you have to regrow what you cut off to heal the wound. And so where you have the options available, like if you do see a potential for two branches on opposite ends of a wound, that's like awesome to heal it. And like the way the Japanese will typically view things is like, if they can trace it back to you having the ability to do something and you didn't, then that's kind of a flaw. So, you know, if it's something like that's why they do take collected trees, they will allot them a certain degree of a leeway, because you weren't there with the oversight the entire life of the tree. But if you do have oversight over the life of the tree, then there's no excuse for it to not be perfect.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. Welcome to the debate section of the podcast.
No, I'm not trying to debate or anything.
That's something
I do a lot with like wound healing here and with tropicals, and it's a pain in the ass. And the only time I've ever made any progress is as soon as we started growing with clip and grow. And not clip and grow, like just trimming it like a hedge, but like I said, you cut where you wait until a tree gets to 60% of the diameter you want. And that diameter can be anything. You grow it to a dinner plate diameter, but now you're going to have to grow two branches that are 50% of a dinner plate to heal that wound. And so, you know, they grow these trees sometimes in giant, giant pots in Taiwan. And, you know, they have a lot of ways to like efficiently grow these things fast. And they don't do clip and grow with junipers, but a lot of that development technique with big pots and growing things very quickly is still the same.
Hey.
So it's, I'm just, for the viewers out, or not viewers, the listeners, you know, it is difficult to heal trees, especially one for one. But like I did start seeing a lot of progress, even with bougainvillea and ilex, but as soon as I started thinking of it as dividing that wound into two.
Yep.
So that's my only piece.
Yeah.
Two salad plates per dinner plate.
Yep.
There.
That's what I'm here for.
Two salad plates per dinner plate. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Or two dessert plates.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's more fun.
I can go for dessert.
Me too.
So let's talk about the, sorry, I don't want to make it sound like, but it's a transition. Let's talk about the Texas show. Bonsai on the Bayou. Mike, are you you going?
Yeah, I'll be there. Okay. I'm teaching a grafting demo or a grafting workshop.
Awesome. So I'll be going. Joe, you'll be there teaching as well on Texas Natives.
Yeah, I'm giving Sweet. A seminar on Texas Natives. Anybody wants to hear more? And there's a lot more plants.
What's your favorite Texas native?
You know, I think right now my favorite one is the native acacia. It's acacia farnesiana, and it's tiny little compound leaves. I haven't had one produce flowers in a pot for me yet, so I'm still figuring that part out. But little bitty flowers, kind of the end of your pinky finger, that are yellow little puffballs. They develop old craggy bark quickly.
I think I've seen those.
They're just wonderful. Again, people kind of stay away from them because they're full of thorns.
Yeah, I do. I'm one of those people. I like, even Texas ebony, I'm like terrified of.
Yeah.
What's the Latin name for that one again?
I don't remember. Joey, Texas do you ebony? Know? Yeah.
Oh no, of the acacia that you're talking about.
It's Acacia farnesiana. But they call it Wisatche here too as well.
Oh, Wisatche. I have worked with that. Yeah. Okay. I have worked with Wisatche. Yeah. That's a scary tree.
No. A wonderful scary. Tree.
That's it scary. Just looks splintery.
No, all. I don't like any tree that has splinters that like break off very easily. So like Texas ebony, acacias of various types. Even rain trees sometimes, man, I can't stand like having thorns break off on me.
Yeah.
I'll deal with bogies and stuff like that, you know, but it's stabby real quick, but then, you know, they don't leave anything.
I laughed because the other plant that I was looking for, we did a South Texas dig this year, and there is a cactus species called Cylindropuntia. So Apuntia is our prickly pear cactus. Mm-hmm. Cylindropuntia is these little cylinders. It's related to the same prickly pear family. But it'll form a multi-branched tree form. It's a beautiful plant. Again, old craggy bark and interesting live veins and dead areas up and down. But it's common name. They also use as jumping cactus, because if you just walk by it, it's like they jump into your
your
legs
or
your hands. And every time I ever mess with them, there's always a thorn I find someplace.
Oh, I got to tell you the story, because this relates to that. Is that I went with Eric years ago in 2014. We went to collect cedar elms in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been to Texas before. You know, my first time going to Texas. And I'd never collected cedar elms. And I'd never dealt with like cactus in any major fashion. And so we went somewhere outside of Fort Worth, and on this big ranch. And so all of the cedar elms were surrounded by these like prickly pear type cactus that were everywhere. And I don't know what kind of cactus they were, but I was really good about avoiding the big spines. Like I thought, okay, you don't mess with the big spines, you're fine. So I'm using my pickaxe and I'm like hitting them out of the way, like knocking them out of the way. Well, what I didn't realize is like all these little hairs are going airborne, and they're these like, they're spines. And so you're getting spines like everywhere. Like I had them in my nose. I had them like, it was miserable. It was miserable.
And they're hooked. Yeah.
And so they're in your clothes. Like, I mean, it literally feels like fiberglass all over you. So yeah, it's miserable.
I bet you wouldn't do that twice.
No, I know better.
He learned his lesson
now,
the
very
first
delicately.
Time.
You move very delicately. So, well, hey guys, I got to feed Lisa and the baby. We got to get some dinner and whatnot. So
you're
I'm
good.
Gonna go ahead and bow out. But Joey, man, always good talking to you.
You
I'm
too,
looking
Mike.
Forward. We gotta grab a drink or something when I see you in Houston.
Yes. Yes, please.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Yeah, we'll hit up the bar.
Thanks for hanging out, Mike. We'll see you in a little while.
See you, Mike.
All right, guys. See you, Carmen. See you, Evan. See you, Joey.
Bye.
All right, dude. So yeah, like we mentioned, the Bonsai on the Bayou, that's gonna be in Houston, Texas. That's gonna be this month, which is April 2024, it's going to be the 25th to the 28th, I believe, because they're packing down on Sunday for the vendors. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
About last weekend of the month, basically.
Yeah. And as far as I know, it's going to It's going to be a really great event. There's lots of vendors, lots of workshops. There's going to be a very lovely bonsai show being put on as well. So are you contributing a tree to the show, Joey?
Yeah, I have two I'm entering that are that have not been seen before. And then I have, they were asking for what they were calling legacy trees, which means trees that have won awards in the past, and I have one of those I'm bringing along as well.
Is it?
It's a Podocarpus I collected down in Corpus Christi.
Oh, awesome. So you're going to really like the Podocarpus that I'm bringing along with me then.
I look forward to it, yeah.
Yep. So I will be bringing a Podocarpus that was actually collected down off of Lake Pontchartrain, off of Pontchartrain Beach in New Orleans. It's a really beefy tree. I've shown Carmen, new pictures of this tree. It's the one that I need to finish detail wiring, and also I'll also be showing a pretty large Japanese boxwood. It's a live oak style, so just a big, broad, old tree that was collected. I think it was collected in like more Panhandle, Florida, but I'd have to get the provenance correct on that one. But two large trees, and I'm going to be vendoring there as well. And I'm supposed to be giving a workshop on water elms. It's kind of been the thing that I've been running around teaching. Whenever I saw you last, Joey, I literally gave a lecture on water elms.
It's great.
Yeah, thank you. And then I'll be going up to Cincinnati, Ohio, and teaching a class on water elms. So it just kind of seems to be my tree right now. So if you are in the local area, if you're going to be around Texas, you can catch Joey's workshop or seminar, more like, or you can catch my water elm workshop. And if you're not in the mood for any of those things, you can just hang out the show and look at the vendors.
Sure, to say hi.
Yeah, come check us out. I'll be there. Joey will be there. Mike will be there. And Carmen won't be at this one. So
I will not be there. Sorry.
But in the near future, when you're done with your apprenticeship.
When I am done apprenticing, I will be at all the places all the time.
Yeah, we'll hope to see Carmen soon. But is there anything else that you would like to put in before we kind of wrap up here, Joey? Is there any comments or any advice to bonsai beginners? This is mostly a bonsai beginner podcast, so is there anything that you'd like to kind of share with everybody before we wrap it up?
Well, first of all, it's been fun. It's my first podcast. I've been on one of these.
Yay!
Thank you.
There's always a first.
But yeah, I mean, so one of the big draws that I had about looking into native plants or even urban plants is it's things that are available near you. You know, bonsai can be as complicated as it needs to be, as you'd like it to be, and it can be as expensive as you like it to be. Sometimes it's easier to let somebody else collect the plants, and then you can, you know, purchase some years under the belt of the tree. But no matter where you are in this world, look around. There's some fantastic material that's often being neglected and forgotten about and not appreciated. And, you know, maybe you can give new life to something that, you know, is meant for the bulldozer or the trash heap. You know, that's it. I love finding fantastic material, but it's actually a little bit more rewarding when I know it's something that I've kind of rescued. And yeah, you know, I feel like an animal shelter, like I have a tree shelter here. You know, it's all these things rescued from certain demise. I'm not sure if that was a final statement, but you know.
No,
get a clear dig.
Plant social services. My friend and I used to, when we were, you know, back just out of college, we'd take in everybody's house plants that were failing, you know. So we called ourselves plant social services. So it's like it's that situation where, yeah, you can find some really cool stuff that, you know, nobody else is going to love. So, and I love that you're doing natives because there's so many plants out there that have so much potential that just haven't been explored yet. So I think everybody should definitely take a look around and see what's in their yard. What have you run over with your lawnmower 10 times? You know, like, what's it doing now? How big's that trunk? So...
Then
if you're lazy like me and haven't actually just dug it out of the ground.
How wonderful would all the different shows be if you go regionally and you actually see the trees that are from that area and you get sort of this tour of
yeah,
you know, the local flora.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea, thinking of what would a show full of natives look like in every state or every region. That'd be really cool.
Yeah. Let's try to see if there's a listener out there and they get inspired and just like try to spark that interest in the local native plants only kind of showcase.
Like that. I'm gonna roll with that at some point, I think.
Yeah, still my idea. Run with it. Whatever. I don't care. Yep. And I'm gonna act like I'm actually I'm probably
it was
not
Joey's
gonna,
idea.
Copyrighted.
Yeah, we're gonna pinky in the brain this situation. I'm just gonna say it like I came up with it, but
yeah, sure.
No, anyway, but yeah, that would be great. Probably gonna forget that, but at the same time, I mean, I think I'm seeing a lot more natives at shows, mm-hmm. much more often, and it's a breath of fresh air for it. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's even being encouraged in these bigger shows. Like, I know one of the things that whenever I was talking to the guys at Bonsai Central, and they were like looking for trees, and I was telling them I have all these Southeast natives, and they're like, Southeast natives, what do you got? And, you know, that's why they were kind of like, you know, like that's why we have a hackberry and a bald cypress and a water elm and all that good stuff going there. And I'm just like, yeah, this is what we have. And it like you said, Joey, it's a very good thing to say to beginners, like don't struggle with the preferred species if they don't work for you. You know, mm-hmm. like some of the Japanese maples, the beautiful maples and the beautiful Satsuki azaleas, you know, all that stuff's great, but it's not always the easiest thing for beginners to kind of latch onto and mm-hmm. be happy with. You don't want to sit there and struggle with the horticulture before you could ever, you know, try to do the aesthetic part if you're just, that's all you have to deal with.
Okay.
So yeah, good little close there. But yeah, so for our usual closeout, we kind of just talk about where people can see your stuff. I know I've seen a lot of your stuff on Instagram from Joey Bonsai. Is that mostly where you post your work?
Yeah, that's where I share most of my my trees and my stories, and the I have a lot of progressions and histories that I put through there. So I'll sometimes it's just a single shot, but other times I'll tell a long rambling story about a particular tree that I hope people appreciate, but you never know. Put it out there in the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's generally where I share my collection and my thoughts on bonsai.
Awesome.
Joey Bonsai.
Yep. Go over to Instagram. I know everybody uses Instagram now, so it's Joey no space Bosai. Joey Yo-N. Bonsai. Oh, sorry about the N. Joey Bonsai. It's been a long day.
There you go.
Yep. Joey Bosai. But no, it's and go over there, give him a follow. Like you said, go check out some of his stories, his progression. He's got some excellent material, very good photography. But yeah, and thank you so much for hanging out. So like we're saying with all the other shout outs, if you wanted to go check out Underhill, you can go to underhillbonsai.com. You can check out some of the articles I've written, some stuff there. Of course, we have Instagram, same name, Facebook, same name. And then you can go over to underhillstore.com. And there's also a hyperlink from the underhillbonsai.com. And we are listing more and more things as time goes on. I'm currently uploading all the Joshua Roth tools that we currently carry, which is basically the whole entire catalog. So if there's anyone out there looking for high quality, intermediate to professional grade tool, just shoot me an email at evan@underhillbonsai.com and I can hook you up. And I will also be doing my best to list some specimen quality trees for sale here really soon on our website as well. And then for, of course, little things, you can go to underhillbonsaistore.com, go to the little things tab. We have a couple of our long sleeve shirts, the I'm into heavy metal shirts. I'm trying to get together an idea for our next print run on t-shirts. We are currently sold out of the I went to a bonsai workshop and all you got was this stump shirt. That one was pretty popular. Might have to just run that one again. Everybody loved that.
That's great.
Yeah. I like that shirt too.
Like that.
Yeah. So, and then for Carmen, where can they go check out your stuff?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai. And also check out the Purple Pot Society, which is the National Women's Bonsai Group. We work to inspire and encourage women to get more involved in bonsai. You don't have to be a woman to join. And actually, we've got some cool new stuff coming up pretty soon. I think we're going to get Sam on here at some point soon.
We've been talking about that for
A minute. Well, we had a meeting, so now we have a plan.
It's official.
It's official. So we can actually like announce some of the fun stuff that we're going to be doing. So keep an eye on that website. I think we're also on, we're also on Facebook and Instagram, Purple Bot Society. So yeah, keep an eye out for some cool up and coming things.
And yeah, that is correct. You don't have to be a woman to join the Purple Pot Society. I am a member and I very much like purple pots as well. I actually have a small collection I'm building of purple pots.
You know, I've noticed a lot more purple pots, and I don't know if it's because I'm looking for them now or because the color is finally catching on, just, you know, more, just becoming more common in, you know, pottery in America. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Make more purple pots, buy more purple pots. They are a great compliment to any kusumono you might have sitting around. So anyway, but yeah, like we were saying, and then also one more thing just to mention really quick, go over to Instagram, Little Things for Bonsai People. Give us a follow there. If you are listening to episodes earlier on and you hear us reference to us critiquing trees, all those trees are normally found on the Instagram page and they correspond with the description, tell you what episode it links up to. Just some helpful stuff there, because I know we're going to be going to the, I'm going to be at the show next week. I'm going to take some pictures of some of the trees and then I will be discussing some of the trees that I've seen there. That's always a fun thing to do.
Send me trees so I can get all judgy.
Yep. We're going to judge some Texas trees in a little while. We're coming for you. But anyway, but yeah, this has been fun. Thanks for hanging out, Joey. And I guess I'll be seeing you pretty soon here.
Absolutely. Nice to meet you, Carmen.
Yeah, it was great to meet you, Joey.
You as well.
Yep. You guys have a great day. And for our listeners, y'all have a great week.